Hello, I'm Tim Robinson, Editor-Chief of Aerospace, and with me today is Deputy Editor Steve Bridgewater and Features Editor Bella Richards. Hello both.
Hi.
Welcome to another edition of Aerospace NOTAM, our regular series of podcasts looking at global aviation, aerospace and space news, and what we've are upcoming in the next issue of Aerospace, this time April 2024. In the magazine, we cover everything from GA to spaceflight, from airliners to airports, from air law to eVTOLs. And I think, and in fact, April, this is our year's anniversary, isn't it, for the podcast, Steve?
You are absolutely right. Wow,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
That year's flown by, hasn't it?
We need a little birthday cake or something.
You
so, do. It's a birthday cake.
Yeah, cake. We're blowing out the birthday cake on our 1 year anniversary. So I hope you've enjoyed it so far and, keep following us. So we start off with the usual stuff. Where have we been in the past month? So I've been doing a bit of space stuff. I went to the Spacecom Expo in Farnborough. That's the UK's biggest sort of trade. Space trade exhibition. Interesting stuff going on there. Lots of things to take in. Lots of forums, lots of conferences, presentations. Some really interesting stuff about grey zone warfare in space and training satellites, optical space domain awareness systems, and one of our new fellows who is ESA reserve astronaut and her day job is trying to get, companies and people signed up for a future British commercial space mission. Yeah. Bella, how about you?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry I wasn't here last month. Unfortunately, I was sick. But, of course, we have Tim and Steve who can do this so easily without me. But, yes, last month, I was at a wonderful event held at the RAS headquarters in London for the International Women's Day. It was a conference led by our president, Carissa Khan, and it was a really, really good conference, honestly. There was a lot of great stuff spoken about. I actually wrote a article on Aero Society, so you're welcome to look at that there, but kind of just looking at the aerospace workforce, how women fit into it, what are kind of the current challenges women have to face today, and I guess how we can make women not seen as the issue and how, you know, women can fit into aerospace and not have to feel like they're fitting into something that wasn't made for them, because obviously, you know, aerospace has included women for a long time now. It was a really great conference, and there was quite a lot of people there, actually. I think over 100 people gathered both, you know, online and at the conference, which was really great. Mostly women, so hopefully next time there'll be a few more men. Talking about a lot of things, like, you know, how setting kind of gender targets and how that can be a good thing, even though it is kind of seen as a controversial thing, you know, building aircraft with women in mind, you know, providing a duty of care for women in the workplace who are typically, you know, the main kind of care givers to children and everything. So, yeah, there was a lot, and I believe you can actually go watch it on YouTube if you're interested. So, yeah, it was a really, really great conference, and I think it was really worth it, because I think sometimes these conferences can say the same things, but I felt like this provided a lot of new insight. And it was honestly so interesting. The whole day, I was just like, wow, that's a really great point. So, yeah,
fantastic.
It was a really great one. Yeah.
Fantastic. So I was also involved. Well, at another space event here at RSHQ just last night, and that was HEO Space, which is
the
Aussies. Yeah, they're pioneering non-Earth imaging or in-space imaging. So basically, using somebody else's satellites to take pictures of other satellites. So basically, you have an Earth observation satellite. You say, I want to look at the ISS, or you want to look at somebody else's satellite, you want to look at some space debris, You task it, it moves around, it doesn't use any propellant, you're not changing the course of it. It just swings its camera around and takes a picture and images it. So a really interesting sort of like evolving niche that I'd not really sort of previously thought about. But there's obviously applications there, military, you know, militaries are interested in that stuff. So there was an interesting Q&A there after about who they wouldn't take imaging requests from, you know. You can probably guess that anyone with a Moscow IP or a Beijing IP is not going to go into their portal and be able to image the X-37. But also stuff like verification in space. So the UKCA issues licenses, and you can check if one satellite is tailgating another satellite if you're getting too close.
Yeah.
So it's almost like not speed cameras in space, but traffic cameras in space so really, really interesting stuff. They've got about 35 satellites in somebody else's satellites that they can access, and now they're doing kind of hosted payloads with their own cameras as well. And their plans are to use multispectral stuff, so SAR, IR. And also maybe extend it to, GEO, high low Earth orbit, and basically, at one point, a lunar orbit as well, and have this sort of network of sensors that you can look at and go, well, is this satellite damaged or is it tumbling out of control or what are we looking at here? So yeah, really interesting lecture. So on to the news. Who wants to start off? Shall I start off with the big
news?
You
go first. I think, yeah, we've had some big news this month, haven't we? I think you go first.
Well, gosh, it's plethora of big news. So big news in, we've had obviously covered, been covering the evolving Boeing story in the magazine as it evolves, and the latest MAX crisis. But the latest one is that Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun is going to step down by the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Stan Deal is out as head of Boeing Commercial Aircraft, and Stephanie Pope, who is Boeing Global Services, she's in as the new BCA chief. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a big shake-up there in
shift.
Boeing's leadership, and it remains to be seen whether this will reassure customers, reassure the airlines, reassure regulators that they're getting their house in order now. They're getting on top of it. So Calhoun is by the end of the year, but also it could be quicker. They could find a new chief quicker. So I'd be interested to see what happens. And there's a couple of interesting things, additional things to that is, firstly, it seems to have been driven by the airlines who went to the board of directors with a sort of ultimatum, basically. Wow, so yeah. The US airlines, your Alaska Airlines, your Southwest, I think, wanted a meeting.
Yeah.
Gave them an ultimatum that we need change here. So it was kind of pushed externally. And the second thing also, there was a thing there about, a tidbit that came about the expected costs of developing a new airplane. So one of the things there is obviously when you get a new CEO, everything is up for grabs, Boeing strategy. So will they develop a new aircraft, to challenge Airbus? And the price tag for that, he said, and I think this is including the total certification, total development, $50 billion.
Wow.
So that is... That is a lot, and that is more than it's a lot of moolah, put it this way.
Yeah.
Interesting. While we're talking, Tim, I've actually just had an email ping up on my screen from, as journalists, we get lots of these surveys and things that are done. And this has come in from a research organization called No Deposit Guide. And they've said that since the start of the 737 MAX incident in January of this year, Google searches for Boeing stock price have increased 809%.
Wow.
Well, I think I think that just fits in with the change of management and reassuring the shareholders.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So what else will we be looking at here? Steve, what have you got?
I've got a civil aviation story. It's a GA story, as you would probably expect from me. And I'm going to go into a little bit more depth than we did in the magazine. So obviously we've only got limited news pages in the magazine, and this is quite an in-depth story in that the Civil Aviation Authority is proposing ways to streamline general aviation licensing in the UK. So, you know, the current licensing has been in place for a long time, and the most recent change was when they introduced the National Private Pilot's License in around 2004, 2005, something like that. So with the CAA post Brexit trying to align with EASA regulations, they're putting out a consultation paper on how we can actually bring licensing more up to date and streamline the whole process. And this is going to be open until May the 22nd of this year. So if it's an area that is of interest to you, please do go on the CAA website put your comments forward. But just as a synopsis, they're looking at discontinuing the issue of the UK private pilot's license under the existing air navigation order as a standalone license. And that would bring it into alignment with FCL and European standards. But it would also allow non-Part 21 type races. Now, non-Part 21 are permit to fly aeroplanes, so quite often historic aeroplanes or kit planes or things like that. So that would bring that into simplify that side of things. But I think one of the key elements here is they're looking to reduce the number of hours a pilot needs to fly to qualify for that private pilot's license.
Oh, wow.
So to get a PPL at the moment, it's a minimum of 45. It's not 45, it's a minimum of 45.
Yeah.
I think most people take in the region of sort of 60 to 70, depending on obviously aptitude, but also how recently, how current they are, how often they can fly. But there's a proposal here to reduce that from 45 hours to 40.
Okay.
And possibly down as far as 35 hours for students who are training with an approved training organisation. So that's a really interesting. They're saying they're not planning to remove any of the content from the syllabus, but just streamline the way that it's taught and actually reduce those hours down. So I think that's interesting in itself. But also the ground exams. So at the moment, you do a myriad ground exams from air law to meteorological conditions, navigation, you name it, stuff like that. They're looking at reducing the number of exams by actually merging some of those subjects and also increasing the length of time that those exams are valid for. Because once you pass your exams, I think they're valid for, I may be wrong, I think it's 2 years. If you don't get your actual private pilot's license within that period, you need to resit those ground exams.
Yeah.
So that's another thing they're looking to do. But also, I think this is quite pertinent with the sort of aviation that we mentioned in aerospace. They're looking at revising the class structure because at the moment there's no type ratings or class ratings for electric or hybrid aircraft. So looking to include that in it as well. So there's a lot more, go on the CAA website, have a good read. There are two documents there. There's one which is the in-depth and there's one which is a condensed summary. But please read both of them. And if you have any interest in general aviation at all and you've got views on this, please go on the CAA website before the 22nd of May and put your opinions forward. Because I think there's some very good proposals in here, but I think that we do need feedback from the entire GA community.
Well, it sounds like it could be slightly cheaper as well, which is good.
Which is what the National Private Pilot's License was intended to do when that came in 2004, 2005. You know, that was the NPPLs, now the LAPL, Light Aircraft Pilot's License. That was, A, to simplify the number of, reduce the number of hours and reduce costs, but also to make flying available to those, such as myself, that couldn't get a Class 2 medical. I'd got a very minor heart condition, which meant I couldn't pass a CAA Class 2 medical. So with the National Private Pilot's License, now the LAPL, it's a driving license, HGV driving license medical. So all of that is included in this documentation as well. So have a good read. And, this could be really good news for encouraging a new generation of pilots. And my new generation, I don't necessarily just mean young people. I mean a whole new influx of people that want to fly. So, really positive move from the CAA.
Cool. All right, Bella, what about you? What have you spotted?
In late February, there was some big news in space, a near miss in space, which ultimately is good news that, no one actually crashed. But yeah, so 28th of February, there was a very close conjunction at, I think, 608 kilometers in low Earth orbit between two non-maneuverable spacecraft. So one of them was a derelict Russian satellite called Cosmos 2221. And I believe it was part of a Russian ELINT, so electronic and signals intelligence satellite, launched at some time. I believe it was abandoned in like the 80s. So it's been there for a long time. And then it came in close proximity to a operational NASA satellite called TIMED. And this satellite, I believe, was launched in 2001 and is studying the influence of the sun and humans on the least explored region of the Earth's atmosphere. And so the miss was a distance less than 20 meters. So that is a very, very short. Yeah, extremely close call, but pretty much the probability of collision was actually only 3% to 8% at the time of closest approach. So it was likely, you know, they were expecting nothing to dramatically happen. But I think the biggest part of this story is that with the amount of satellites in low Earth orbit now, this type of possible collision is actually still really rare. So according to LEO Labs, they're a company that monitors these things. They monitor space. They monitor satellites. They were looking at this closely. They had received a lot of updates from their global network hours before the event, kind of, you know, testing whether anything was going to happen dramatically. And they said that in the last 2 years, there have only been six other events with a miss distance of less than 20 meters, which is not a lot when you think of how many satellites are now in space. And the great news is that this event, if both crashed like right into each other, would have created a massive amount of space debris. So up to 7,500 fragments, if you're looking at the kind of total mass together.
Sorry, that's great news.
No, great news that it didn't happen. Great news that we avoided it. It would not be great news.
No.
Yeah, and but the LEO Lab said, you know, the more likely event that would have been, you know, that a solar array would have clipped other object's main body, but that would have still created up to like 2,500 fragments of debris, which if you remember the anti-satellite test that happened in November 2021 with the Russian satellite, that created around that much debris and caused a lot of fear, you know, with the International Space Station, because, you know, no matter how small it is, those pieces going at an extremely fast pace can make big damage to infrastructure in space and even, you know, astronauts. So I think this was a really interesting story because, again, ultimately it was good news that nothing happened, but I think it's a big reminder that we do need these companies looking at space. We need constant eyes on space. And then also a reminder that future satellites that are being developed do need a deorbiting plan or, you know, a plan to put them in a graveyard orbit, or at least, you know, companies like Astroscale or other companies who can kind of drag non-maneuverable satellites into a better place. I think it's just a reminder that these things do happen despite how rare, they can still cause significant damage. So, yeah, it was a really interesting story.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Right, so back to me again. So, so what else we got in the news? So the other interesting news was in eVTOLs this month. So Vertical Aerospace, UK eVTOL developer, they had a shareholder's letter out. They're now working on their second prototype. You remember that the first one, it had a uncrewed test, had a hard landing, written off. That one, the second one now, it's much improved. It's got about 60-70% new components, including I think the prop blades, faster and quieter than the original one. It's in final assembly now, and they're talking about flying it at Farnborough. So the shareholder's letter says something like, "I'm looking forward to our pilot displaying it at Farnborough." So
that would be cool.
That'll be really good thing to look forward to Farnborough. Obviously, last year we had the Volocopter flying at Paris in the distance, very very quiet. You know, we were straining to. So have that. So I don't think it's going to be joining the Red Arrows or doing loop the loops, but it'd be a great test if, you know, even if you just get it and hover it to see people's reactions, hear how quiet it is. So
that's going to be a British debut of a British type at Farnborough. When do you reckon the last time we had an all new British aircraft debuting at Farnborough?
Gosh.
BA146, maybe, something like that.
RJ, well, RJ.
Would you, RJ.
Where would you call it, the RJ? Yeah.
Yeah, there was the Speed Twin, but I think that may have been before. But yeah, interesting, we've spoken quite a bit on the pod in over the last year about a hopeful renaissance in British aviation. And, hopefully this is a good sign if we're going to get
a great sign.
The aircraft will be test flown and ready to be at Farnborough.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a bit of an aggressive schedule between now and July, but let's fingers crossed. Yeah, what else have you seen, Steve?
I want to briefly throw back, in a way, a little bit of a tangent to your Boeing story, and that Japan has announced this week. This is something that's actually news that has broken since we went to print with the magazine, so this isn't in the magazine itself. But Japan and JAXA, we've got this good relationship with JAXA now from the interview that we did with them last year out in Kyoto. JAXA have announced that they are looking to develop an all new Japanese airliner. So obviously, Mitsubishi Regional Jet, last real attempt at something like this. But the interesting factor is they're looking here at hydrogen propulsion. So do you think maybe they are, perhaps looking at the woes that Boeing have got with the 737, the fact that Airbus have got a long waiting list for the A320. Is there an opportunity here that Japan is looking at?
Well, I think there could be. I think one of the things that's come out from it is, first off, people from the Boeing saga is, first, people like a stable duopoly. It's in Airbus's interest. It's in the customer's interest. It's in a stable duopoly. But who you have in that duopoly, that's the key question. So I think, maybe there is, obviously we saw Comac at the Singapore Air Show. They've got their ambitions, their plans. They've got C919. Will it change Boeing straight away? Probably not. But they are there. They're marking their territory out, and it could be a left field. Could someone come out of left field? So we have Jet Zero in the US. You've got Embraer there, who might be thinking about going into the larger aircraft. Interesting that Japan is. I mean, because MRJ, as nice an aircraft as it was, didn't go anywhere. So for them to come back and to have another go, and think it's worthwhile having it, and also hydrogen, maybe this is the killer app that would persuade airlines to go with a new OEM and actually take a bet bet on the farm that way. So interesting there, and how that all sort of shakes out. And also, like you said with JAXA, we have this, the UK has now got the relationship on the military side, and Italy has got the relationship with GCAP. So you could sort of think about there about how there's technology transfer or technology overlap from things like advanced composites and manufacturing. Would that then flow over to a, potential Japanese, digital design tools, and things like that? So all the stuff that they might be, working on for GCAP, a company like Mitsubishi, when we're coming with GCAP, would that then flow on to a civil airliner? So yeah, interesting days indeed.
Yeah, definitely. Bella, anything more from you?
Yeah, I think all of my news today is good news, which is nice for a change. this was also in the latest magazine, but I'll give a bit more information. So the International Air Transport Association released their annual safety report and basically said that 2023 was the safest year in the last decade for flying, which is actually really great news after everything happening, with Boeing, even though this is 2023 and obviously everything going with Boeing right now started this year. I think it's really good PR news for the air industry. But basically, the report revealed that there were no hull losses or fatal accidents involving passenger jet aircraft in 2023, and obviously just a single fatal accident involving a turboprop aircraft which happened in January last year with Yeti Airlines, which sadly did result in quite a lot of deaths, I think 72 fatalities. But ultimately, you know, with 37 million movements worldwide, and obviously an increase of flights since 2022 and obviously the previous year with the pandemic, the overall accident rate, according to IATA, was 0.80 per million sectors, so pretty much one accident for every 1.26 million flights. And as I said, the lowest rate in over a decade. And they said a really interesting quote: at this level of safety, on average, a person would have to travel by air every day for 103,239 years to experience a fatal accident, which there's a lot of nuances to that. But I guess this is a really good story. And if you want to look at it, just comparing the years, I was looking at, you know, the fatal accidents between 2022 and 2023. As I said, 2023 had one. And 2022 had five. One passenger jet, if you remember, would have been the China Eastern Airlines one, I believe in March, and four turboprop fatal accidents. And so, you know, even though any is still more than the industry wants, it's still really great news to see that we're flying up to pre-pandemic levels, pretty much getting beyond that in some regions, and yet passenger travel is seen as still safe. And I think, as I said before, even though everything happening with Boeing has started this year, I think it's nice because, you know, I think we've talked about this before, the conversation of flying has kind of transcended the aviation industry, where people are like, oh, I don't want to fly Boeing, or, you know, people are kind of freaking out. And so it's good to be reminded that no, air travel is still really safe.
Yeah.
Despite the obvious.
I think the thing though is that there is a mismatch between the stats, between the IATA stats and what the trade publications, what we report on, and what we, the professional community does, and now some of the public perceptions and some of the hype and the, I wouldn't say misreporting, but the, because obviously there's a large number of Boeing airliners flying, there are a large number of turnbacks or diversions or technical slags or things like that, which happen all the time, never get reported
exactly.
on. And now everybody is, oh, there's, you know, this aircraft has had a go round. You know,
which is so normal.
Oh, it's a Boeing. Yeah.
So there's a sense there that there is a, I think there's a bit of a mismatch there between, you know, what's actually going on and, you know, the good news, and then, bit of hype, bit of fake news, bit of panic and hysteria in some quarters.
Yes.
But what is also interesting is that, again, we didn't get it in the magazine because it came in too late, but the FAA is increasing oversight of United.
Yeah.
So they are now looking at in sort of safety incidents, low-level safety incidents, and it's sort of like almost a widening of the kind of Boeing safety oversight that is going on there. You know, first off, it starts on a single door plug. Then they go to the factory. Then they're looking at Spirit. Then they're looking at that auditing. Then the entire production thing. Now it's kind of almost as if it's gone over to the airlines as well. And now the FAA is under, I think, you know, quite a bit of pressure from the public, from the media, from politicians, is are we sure everything's safe? So they're now looking at, you know, it's now extended to the airlines. United is kind of basically, you know, they're clamping down on that. So all good stuff in improving safety and improving oversight, but it is a sort of symptom of this mismatch, if you like.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, and just taking that a step further, the other news item I want to talk about, Tim, is actually the latest order from American, which is interesting that American have still gone with the MAX. You know, they've done a three-way split for their big order. I mean, they've ordered 260 narrow-body aircraft in March, but they've gone for the 737 MAX 10 with options. They've also gone for the A320neo from Airbus, And interestingly, the Embraer 175. So, you know, a three-way, could you say hedging your bets possibly, but certainly showing backing for Boeing in terms of they're still in the mix there. So
they're still confident,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the exact numbers for those who are interested is in the magazine, but 85 MAX 10s with options for another 75, 85 A321s, and also a firm order with Embraer for 90 Embraer 175s and options for 43 more. So really big order. Make sure in March, as Tim, you and I have said, there was a big show in Singapore a couple of weeks before that. And we seem to have all the orders are coming at the moment outside of the big show. So if you are working for one of the airlines, if you're thinking of buying some aeroplanes, please wait till Farnborough. It makes our job a lot easier if you can announce it at a big show. Thank you very much. Public service information broadcast over.
Okay. So the probably the last one, last news is, and this is also big news. I hope everyone saw the video and the launch video, and that was Starship's third flight.
Yeah.
So this is me stealing your sandwiches, Bella, your space sandwiches. But I mean, it didn't go fully as planned, but there was some amazing footage. And particularly the plasma re-entry, you know, plasma forming on the re-entry of a Starship. And it did seem to, what struck me was, firstly, wow, look at that, this footage, because they were beaming it to the Starlink satellites. So you weren't having to wait until, to kind of download it from what was left of the thing. But also how far it got down, even though it was kind of seemed to be tumbling out of control. And it's the biggest object put into space since Skylab.
Yeah.
Single object.
That was such an awesome
incredible
thing to watch. Yeah, definitely.
And like you say, it was awesome to watch. And I think it was such a professional broadcast as well. It was just, I've got friends who are not particularly interested in aerospace that tuned in to watch that launch because, you're never sure what's going to happen with a SpaceX launch. But just because it was such a slick production and, I need a GoPro camera. I need the one that was on the side of that rocket showing all of that because it seemed to survive a very long time for a GoPro,
it
didn't
did.
It?
Yeah, it was great. And I believe the next launch could be really imminent. I mean,
yes.
Who knows the SpaceX.
I mean, this is also when you look back about how they how they totaled the launch pad, people were looking at the launch pad and going, well, that's something you fixed for at least
for years.
Yeah, years.
I remember people writing on Twitter or what's it called?
X.
Oh my goodness. Saying like, no, I don't believe it probably won't launch for another 10 years.
Yes.
Okay.
And if we can find out who fixed that launch pad, can I have their number? Because we've got some potholes here that really could do with filling in. We could, we definitely need the same group. Just before we dash off for the break, I've got a couple of other minor stories I want to just put in. And you won't be surprised, guys, that they're GA stories. But the problem with having the magazine is we're limited in the amount of pagination we've got. And I've got a couple of stories which I think are really important, just one-liners just to put in for the grand scheme of things. And one is a bit of a follow-up for an article that I wrote about 18 months ago on unleaded fuel. So we looked at why the general aviation world wasn't using unleaded fuel when the fuel was available. And the University of North Dakota, actually, back last year, they converted their fleet of aircraft to run on UL-94, so unleaded fuel. They've actually put a report out now. They've returned to flying with leaded fuel. And this is after they found 128 episodes of recessed valve seats or valve problems in engines that had used unleaded fuel. Now, some of these actually happened after the aircraft had returned to leaded fuel, but they all occurred to aeroplanes that had run on unleaded fuel. So I think that throws something else into the mix there on unleaded fuel.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we've really got to monitor moving forwards. Also, on a fueling point of view, Aura Aero, our friends in Toulouse that are building the two-seat aerobatic aeroplane and also looking at an electric regional aircraft, have actually done the first, we can say engine run of the electric. They've turned on their electric motor for the first time on their Integral E, which is their electric aeroplane.
They've plugged it in. Can we say they've plugged it in?
Yeah, they've charged it up, they press the switch, and the propeller turns and everything's gone well. So that bodes well for a test flight in the coming months. They're actually also announced a collaboration with the French Gliding Federation to create an electric tow plane. Again, different avenues there to explore electric aircraft. And finally, just on a really fun story, I don't know whether you guys saw this, but the Gravity Jets guys ran the world's first jetpack race. Was in Dubai. It was around the harbour in Dubai, around buoys floating in the harbour. 1,700 horsepower jetpacks. 8 pilots racing each other. I want to do that.
Can I put a bid in the race, for that? Yes.
But we've seen the Red Bull Air Race. We've seen lots of these different high adrenaline sports. I think this is taking this to a new level now. So, yeah, the world's first jetpack race. Brilliant.
Yeah, so interesting.
Fantastic. All right, so we're going to take a little bit of a break now, and we shall join you back when we go through what's upcoming in the next issue, and I look forward to our events. So back in a bit. And back, we're back. Welcome back to Aerospace NOTAM. April issue is coming up. You can see the front cover there behind. If you're watching our video, if you're not, if you listen to this, you'll just have to imagine it. what have we got in this issue? So one of the things obviously is Boeing, a big, fast moving story to keep track of, but we have a good bit of analysis there of Boeing at the crossroads and looking at how did they get into this position anyway, where they're in this crisis and potential routes out? Very good there, a piece there by Scott Hamilton of Lehman News. He's a really good sort of analyst, keeps track of what's happening with Boeing. We've got very, very, very good contacts there and got the inside story there on what might happen. What else have other people got in this issue we're looking forward to?
Segueing neatly into that, we've also got an article. We touched on a subject before the break on Chinese airliners. Mm-hmm. Alan Dron's done a feature on not just C919, which, of course, debuted at Singapore. We spoke about that in our Singapore podcast. Also the ARJ21, which was on static display at Singapore. But just looking at whether China can break that duopoly that we spoke about in the first half of the pod. And I think the interesting point there is not just on the fact that the technological part, but also the hearts and minds, if you like.
Yeah.
We know generally the public don't really care what they fly on. You know, you get on a metal tube, perhaps a little bit, as we said, there's a bit more of a heightened awareness on the Max at the moment. But particularly when it's the American market, they worry about anything which is a Chinese product. You know, whether it's a Chinese smartphone that might be listening to you or the perceived quality of a toy which is made in China. And Alan's asked the question there about do we think that the traveling population, particularly in the US, would get on a Chinese aeroplane? And I think that's a question that remains to be answered.
It's a really interesting article, actually.
It is it looks at the history of it as well as just the contemporary aircraft.
I mean, the other thing there is also you think about, sort of smartphones. There was an interesting there point in the article there about the difference between sort of smartphones and EVs, you know, electric vehicles. So electric vehicles, China does batteries on a scale that we really kind of can't comprehend. And this is probably why they're going to be one of the leading players in EV tolls, because that technology is going to transfer over to electric flight.
But there's
a point there in that when you develop an airline, you're not doing the incremental thing of a smartphone where you can make these incremental things. The technology refreshes every 18 months. You've got to get it right first time.
Exactly.
And with the ARJ21, arguably. They haven't got it right with that, unless you wanted an 80s style, MD MD80. C919 is closer, so it's a modern aircraft. It's closer. It's an alternative. But you know there is the next question, and we were talking earlier about what would if you were an airline and you have somebody a unknown OEM coming to you with an airliner, and you're thinking about do I take the risk?
Yeah,
it's got to be something that is going to give you a double digit fuel burn.
Yeah.
It's got to give you that leap ahead that you take a chance. Just like Frank Borman, and it was Northwest, wasn't it? Was it Northwest or
Eastern?
Northeastern, yeah. Yeah. It did with Airbus. Is something that gives you that little bit of an edge that you are willing to take a little bit of a risk in order to get that kind of advantage over your competitors. So
China needs that breakthrough customer, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. What about you, Bella? What are you looking forward to?
Yeah. Teresa Poltorova wrote a really detailed look at the current state of the UK's launch sector, specifically kind of looking at both rocket companies and spaceport developers and whether we'll see a launch this year or at least soon. Since was it last January when Virgin Orbit? That seems like a really long time ago. But, you know, last January, obviously, the failure of the Start Me Up mission. Since then, there's kind of been it's gone a little bit quiet with if you're really keeping up to date with everything, there's still been news. It's not like there's nothing. But I guess the launch sector has been a little bit quiet. So Teresa kind of provided a really comprehensive look at the companies in spaceports, you know, like Space Hub Sutherland, SaxaVord, Skyrora, Orbex, all the others, looking at where they're at now and whether they're even closer to seeing a launch from British soil this year, or at least soon. And I think since the article was published, SaxaVord received 10 million more in funding from the government for an orbital launch in 2024. So it looks like there's, much pressure for there to be a launch. And then I guess a really interesting part of the article was she looked at, you know, even just the business case for UK launches and whether they even have a chance against the likes of, you know, SpaceX, because despite being a foreign vehicle, you know, it still does provide the cheapest options, especially against micro launches. You know, there's a lot of, I guess, controversy of whether micro launches it worth it, considering the cheap option you can get with SpaceX. But the good news is, I think, and what she talks about in the article is that a lot of the UK space industry disagrees. They say there is a huge business case for small launches, especially with the upsurge of interest since, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the Soyuz medium lift rocket, you know, not being an option for European launches anymore. So it's a really great article. And she kind of wraps it up saying, you know, I hope that there's a launch, but don't get your hopes up too soon. So, I really hope there'll be kind of progress towards one, but I'm not sure if it's going to be this year.
Steve, what have you got?
What have I got? We've had an airline story. We've had a space story. We'll touch on one of our military stories, shall we? And it's an article by Charlotte Bailey on her visit out to the Saab factory in Sweden, where she went to see the Gripen E production line. Of course, Sweden, NATO's newest members, very topical at the moment, bringing around 100 aircraft into the NATO fold. But looking at how Gripen E differs from the earlier models, and just a really interesting look at an aircraft that we don't tend to focus on that much. You know, in the grand scheme of things, yeah, Sweden really is a mini powerhouse in this sort of thing.
Yeah, and obviously new NATO member.
Exactly.
New NATO member, and I think also that it's people don't because it looks so similar to the Gripen C. People don't realise it is completely different under the skin, and they've done an absolute amazing job in. Separating out the mission avionics from the flight controls and things like that, and that is now what Tempest, GCAP, NGAD, they're all looking at doing this. Sweden has pioneered the way here. You don't then have to do the regression testing of millions and millions of lines of code.
Yeah.
And upgrades are far simpler. You've basically got a flying smartphone OS.
Yeah.
You know, with a fighter wrap around it. So really interesting stuff there. So I suppose the only other thing to mention for this issue in terms of features is we got a full report on Singapore. Obviously, it's selected highlights. If you want to read the whole stuff, it is on the Inside blog. We've got lots of pictures, videos, stuff there from all the big news from Singapore, but it's in the magazine as well. And also Afterburn. What have we got in Afterburn this month?
Yeah, we've got quite a lot in Afterburner. We've got a little news bit on the RAS Preston branch, who has been working with the University of Central Lancashire. Do I say that right? My Australian speak is often wrong with pronouncing. Steve, is that right?
Lancashire. Sure.
Lancashire. Okay, sure. anyways, they got to work with the BAE Flying Club based at Blackpool Airport to provide a bunch of aerospace engineering students with some practical flying experience, so with a few Piper aircraft. So it was really cool, I guess, putting their theory into practice. And so there's some photos in there. And then we've got a very interesting Winkle, The Extraordinary Life of Britain's Greatest Pilot, a very popular book. And there's a very interesting review in Afterburner. All I'll say is you should definitely read it.
Yes,
Yeah, definitely read it. And then we've just got the minutes from the 157th annual general meeting of the RAS. So if you want to know all the behind the scenes of what goes into the RAS, the budget, everything like that, have a read. As usual, library editions, the diary, new member spotlight, and lots of people for the elections. So it's a busy, busy Afterburner.
And also, obviously, if you are a member or you're involved with any of the our local branches, do send your news, do send your things, items for the diary or reports of past events, photos. We like to include them. We love to include that.
Yes.
To Bella here who will endeavour to fit them into Afterburner. So keep us up to date with all your branch and division news, please.
Please do.
Right. Okay. So next on the agenda, what have we got?
Upcoming events. Where are
upcoming
we?
Upcoming events. What's happening?
Well, I think the first one we've got is 4th of April. So the first one for the April month, Lilium Jet. So a presentation at 4 Hamilton Place, our HQ, with the chief test pilot for Lilium. So of all of the eVTOL aircraft, I think Lilium just stands out as being completely different to everything else, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So that's going to be really, really interesting. Looking forward to that.
Ducted, basically a ducted fan electric biz jet, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's going to be fascinating. Then corporate partners. So our corporate partners, they get access to exclusive events behind closed doors. You get kind of frank chats and things like that and networking opportunities. And we've got Chief of the Air Staff, Sir Richard Knighton, Royal Air Force. He's coming to talk, give a fireside chat, and there's a networking reception on 9th of April. That is something not to be missed. Chance there, mm-hmm. if you are a corporate partner or an employee of your corporate partners, what you want to do, get in touch with either ourselves or your corporate partner representative. Should be able to sort of track them down and see if you can get along to that. That's going to be well worth going to. Intimate chat with Chief of the Air Staff and what's on his agenda. And then we've got returning in massive amounts of glory, Aviation Quiz Night, 24th of April. Ooh. Steve, you are quiz master for the night again.
Quiz master again. I'm writing questions again. I won't give you any hints as to what this year's themes are, but last year's themes included Greek mythology. Sounds very obscure, but it was actually clues that led to a name of an aircraft, so that had a name in common with a character from Greek mythology, such as Poseidon or Apollo or something like that. And I think we also had a geography round last year, so we gave you a description of a town or a city, and that it also led you to the name of an aeroplane, whether it was Stirling or Lancaster or Boston or something like that. So think laterally. This is not just a general knowledge quiz on your knowledge of what's happened in the last year of aerospace, although there will be rounds on military and commercial aerospace, so do swat up on those. But there are some more obscure esoteric rounds as well, just for a bit of fun. So looking forward to that. It's 24th of April. So either bring your own team or come along on your own, and we will put you with other random strangers to form a team. And that might sound odd, but last year's winners were a team of people who had not met each other until the evening.
That's
so
awesome.
The important thing, though, you need a ticket. You can't just turn up on the night. This did sell out last year, and it's close to selling out again. So get online, book your ticket for the quiz. It's 24th of April.
And if you're in a company and want to bring a company team along, you know, and uphold your company's prestige, and you know, come on, it's going to be fun rivalry. There's going to be cash bar nibbles there. It's just going to be a fun evening all told. Really good fun. Then we've got a 3-day conference, haven't we, on Energy from Space. Bella, that sounds like up your street.
Yeah, so we've got the International Conference on Energy from Space. That's from the 17th to the 19th of April, which 3 full packed days. It's going to be really cool. A lot of people are coming, you know, the UK Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, obviously RES, UK Space Agency, ESA. I could go on. There's lots, but pretty much we're going to be, I guess, gaining insights into, you know, the space-based solar power concepts and technologies, and I guess the current challenges, whether it's safety, security, environmental impact, and looking at kind of the global leaders in it so far, and I guess exploring the intersection of space and energy sectors and so on. And it's going to be a really, really packed event with lots of great speakers. So you should definitely come. So the 17th to the 19th of April.
So I mean, power from space, it's important because one, net zero, so it's cheap 24/7 power,
and 24/7.
Two, it's a potential, you know, building all this massive infrastructure in space. Previously, we couldn't do it because, you know, everyone said, oh, it's too costly. Now you might have Starship there.
Exactly.
Starship will be there. It's 100 tons to low Earth orbit.
Exactly.
What do you want to build? Basically, I think what the question could be. Steve, you're off to Germany.
I'm looking forward to hearing about the Energy from Space conference because I'll be in Germany during that time. I'll be out at Aero Friedrichshafen, the biggest general aviation trade show in Europe, and it's my first time there since about 2007. So I'm really looking forward to going back. And this year I'll be travelling with David Chin, who is next year's president of the society, takes over in May. So if you are at Friedrichshafen, if you'd like to meet next year's president, meet David, drop me a line, try and get something in the diary. We're there for the entire week. Really looking forward to that. I always tell people Friedrichshafen Aero is the only GA show which includes everything from powered parachutes through to business jets. And it literally does have that whole spectrum. So, yeah, really looking forward to that. That's 17th to the 20th of April. Right. And then what else have we got, Tim? We've got another corporate partners briefing, haven't we?
Yeah, so we've got another corporate partners briefing and a CA address from its chair, so Stephen Hillier, going on about the state of the nation, really, kind of thing on civil aviation safety, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, you know, this month we've got the two sort of heads of, one, the RAF, military aviation, two, Sir Stephen Hillier, head of the CAA. So, I mean, that's a really, really great month there. Again, corporate partner briefing, exclusive to our corporate partners and their employees. Go along to that. And that's 30th of April here at RAS HQ. And then finally, the big one coming up in May is Future Combat Air and Space Capability Summit. Follows on from last year's big summit and high profile. It's back, bigger, even bigger and better. Some really, really interesting air forces and speakers we've got down for that. It's covering a whole load of things from things you might kind of normally kind of guess at, like, you know, GCAP, future fighters, but also drones, networking, combat cloud, cyber, space, you name it. It's going to be really, really interesting. Can't wait.
Maybe some AI.
And even AI, yes, possibly. So moving on, we're now up to what have we been watching, reading, playing? Anyone been aeronautical, space, or aviation?
Bit of a busy month. I mean, the way magazine cycles work is sometimes you have a short month, sometimes you have a long month. This has been a short month because of Singapore and various other things. So I'm still reading Chris Hadfield's Apollo Murders. Tim, yep. Don't tell me who did it.
Right, okay. Bella, what about you?
I'm the same. I'm still reading Space, The Human Story by Tim Peake. So hopefully I'll have an update maybe next month.
So, yeah, we're just about to enter the busy period of the year with the run-up to Farnborough. So, yeah, watch this space if any of these two actually finish these books.
Yeah.
So I've been – so it's not – this is slightly a tangent, but it is sort of space-related, I suppose, but Free Body Problem. That's come out – that's a series that's come out on Netflix. It's adapted from Chinese science fiction. Really, really good award-winning Chinese science fiction, and it's basically all about the Fermi paradox, which is if you do the calculations, the universe should be teeming with life. So where is everybody? And also one of the solutions to that is the dark forest, which is basically, the universe is teeming with life, but nobody speaks up because there are predators in the forest. So this whole thing is about, what happens if Earth puts up our hand and shouts out in this dark forest, and what are the consequences? Really good, really good, thoughtful science fiction. There are a couple of helicopters in it so far.
There you go.
That's fine.
So I'm enjoying that. Right. So on this, we're round about up to the end of it now. Where can people keep up to date with Horace and the Mag? We're all still on X, aren't we?
Still on X. Yeah. I'm on at RAES Steve B. Bella.
Yep. I'm on RAES Bella R.
I'm RAES Tim R. I need to get myself onto LinkedIn at some point as well. And obviously we've got the society Facebook as well that's pumping out stories and Insta and things like that. And as ever, views, questions, feedback, what do you want to see? Do send them our way. We're always interested in hearing your feedback on how the podcast is doing. And we're on SoundCloud, Spotify, and iTunes. So no excuse to miss us.
Definitely.
And we've been here a year now. How incredible is
yes.
that?
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Wow. Have we been here a year? We've not been taken off air yet.
Not yet. No.
On that note, I will leave you, and we'll see you next month.
See you next month, guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye.